LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Courtney Brown, who joins us to discuss the Farsight Institute's latest project, Aliens on Iapetus. This remote viewing documentary focuses on what appears to be a huge set of structures on the surface of Iapetus, a moon of Saturn. The apparent structures are clearly visible in a photograph that was taken by the Cassini space probe that still orbits Saturn. We now know what these things are, who built them, and why. We also know what happened to those who stayed there, and how they died. This was not a military outpost, not a spy base, nor an industrial or mining location. It's actually more amazing than anyone could possibly have imagined. The project's findings also pose some fascinating questions. How similar were the beings on Iapetus to ourselves, and can their story teach us anything about our own past and possible future? Could it be that life in the solar system did not begin on Earth, but on other planets long cold and dead, or even completely destroyed? And does our selective blindness to the cosmic catastrophes of high antiquity obscure terrible truths now all but lost in the mists of time? Cutting-edge physics and emerging research into psychic phenomena may just offer some answers. Hello and welcome, Courtney, and thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com. This is your sixth time, which marks something of a record.
Well, actually, Greg, I really enjoy being on your show. You're a great host and a great interviewer, and so I really look forward to it. Now I'm honored to be invited back.
Excellent. Well, today we're going to be talking about the Farsight Institute's latest remote viewing project, Aliens on Iapetus. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yeah, you are.
Splendid. Now, I know you like to, for new listeners, to shoot out the remote viewing basics a bit about Farsight Institute and yourself. So just give everyone the basics in a nutshell.
I can give that in about 30 seconds. Remote viewing is a mental procedure that's used to transfer information. You think of it like psychic stuff, but it's different. But transfer information, perceptual information across time and space, and apparent complete violation of the mainstream laws of physics. We do understand the physics of it now, and so it's not in violation to the physics as we understand it, but Farsight Institute, that's F-A-R-S-I-G-H-T, like seeingfar.org, O-R-G, because we're a nonprofit. The Farsight Institute is the largest, biggest, best venue. I can say that because we're the only venue for these huge public projects using the world's absolute best remote viewers who have trained for well over a decade, sometimes 20 years, in the use of these procedures that were developed by the United States military and used for espionage purposes. We use them for scientific exploration because we're a civilian venue, and we also use them for exploration, not just scientific exploration, not just science projects involving time and physical reality, but also exploration. And the Iapetus project that we're talking about today is part of that.
Now, this latest project is, as you mentioned, following hot on the heels of the previous one, remote viewing Cydonia Mars.
And yeah, this was a package of three. Our remote viewers are prima donnas, to be quite honest, and they have always liked to have the remote viewing focus on earthly targets, not extraterrestrial type stuff, because they really want to have their art, which they have perfected. They're like Lang Lang with the piano. They are the best of the best, and they want their art to be presented with the appropriate reverence, appropriate environment. And so they have always hesitated to have remote viewing done with extraterrestrial type of stuff because it brings another woo-woo factor in it. And they want it. It's not that they don't think that extraterrestrial stuff exists, but they wanted the remote viewing component to be considered seriously. And so for years, I promised them I would do no extraterrestrial targets. But of course, I always lie whenever I promise somebody that I'll never do something. But I did hold off for a long time. I did realize, however, that if I gave them extraterrestrial targets twice, they might quit on me. So this was one time, one project that had three extraterrestrial targets. And the first one was the face on Mars in Cydonia. We wanted to know what that was and what it was like when it was in its prime. We wanted to know what this anomaly is on the wall of a crater that looks like some structures, very clear structures in a NASA photograph, on Iapetus. And we wanted to know what that was. And then we also wanted to know about the Phoenix Lights. And the Phoenix Lights episode, that's March 13th, 1997, the one that was witnessed by the Governor Fief Symington and literally hundreds of thousands of others, people, that's coming out in mid-July. So, Greg, you might want to invite me back for that one. But the remote viewing is all done on that one. And so I got three extraterrestrial targets in one go. And this time I am telling you the truth about the future projects, although I never tell people about future projects. This one is sort of obvious. If I assign my remote viewers extraterrestrial targets again, they might quit on me. So we're going to be staying close to home, but still really exciting projects after this. So we got three extraterrestrial ones at a go, and this is the middle one, Iapetus. And it's really one of the most bizarre and interesting projects that exists.
I had a couple of listeners grumble a bit about the fact that you said that you were quote-unquote lying to the remote viewers, to Daz and Dick, about, for example, the 9/11 project that you did. But, to my mind, I was kind of going, well, I think in any area of science that is not particularly well established in the mainstream, I'd hesitate to even use the word lying. It's more about you don't reveal all the information at any given time.
No.
Because you can't, Greg. Because the experiment won't work otherwise.
Greg, I was lying. Let those people in the audience, let them go jump in a lake and jump off a cliff. They don't know anything about how the remote viewing process works. It has to be done under totally blind conditions. And myself as the chief investigator has to do whatever I can possibly do to make it so that the remote viewers have absolutely no idea that something's coming. Now, with the 9/11 project, let those people in your audience that are grumbling, let them grumble. Let them hate. Let them do whatever they want. They don't know squat. The reality is, if we're remote viewing to work with these viewers, with the 9/11 project, these viewers are so good, their very first session, they would have seen the Twin Towers come down, and they would have known with the first session, this is 9/11. So the only way I could have pulled off this project to get seven targets in, so a complete understanding of the 9/11 events could have happened, was to lie, partially mislead, to blatantly lie to the remote viewers over a period of well over 10 years, saying, and I did it on radio as well, so that would be convincing. I said, we would never touch the 9/11 stuff. That's one project we will, I have the emails I saved to them. I said, we will never touch that. And it was because I did that when they actually did those targets under totally blind conditions to the absolute last target, they had no idea what the project was about. And when they finished it and when they were going to get the target feedback, it was on a conference call using GoToMeeting, which is like Skype, between Daz Smith and Dick Elgar. You could see the sweat on Daz Smith's forehead. Dick Elgar couldn't sleep for 37 hours. They both thought maybe it was over, that they couldn't remote view anymore because they saw all this 9/11 stuff, but they knew it couldn't be 9/11 because Courtney said he'd never give that project. They thought they were finished. They were over, that they couldn't do it anymore. That level of doubt has to be there. It's not optional. It has to be there or the remote viewing will not work. Because they have to rely on raw perceptions. You cannot rely on anything coming in from the conscious mind. Blind means blind. It means no foreknowledge. And the trouble is, when the remote viewers get so good, it's hard to keep a target totally blind to them because their own perceptions are good enough. So if they can recognize some elements of a target, you might only get one session. It'll be a session where you clearly demonstrate that the remote viewing works, but that's not what you want. You want the story behind, you know that the remote viewing works. Now you want the story behind everything. And it's my job to get that story out. And I have to do whatever I can do to get that. Now, let me give you an example of Audrey Hepburn. Audrey Hepburn, the famous actress Audrey Hepburn, she was new at one point to the movie making, and she was in a movie, and she just couldn't do tears. She couldn't, I mean, it just didn't work. She needed to do a scene, but she needed to cry, and it just wasn't convincing. So what the director did, he didn't tell anybody. He didn't tell anybody there was a trick or anything. He just started to yell at Audrey Hepburn. She said, this is ridiculous. You're ridiculous. How could you ever get a job like this? I don't want to deal with you ever more. This is the most stupidest thing I've ever. You call yourself an actress and this is the kind of crap that you're giving. Well, she thought she was being fired and she literally just started crying. And as soon as the tears went on, he said, cameras roll. Boom. And they caught it. And it was the best scene. It was caught perfectly. And after the movie was filmed, he said, Audrey, you did great. You did great. Thanks a lot. It was wonderful. So he wasn't firing her. He was doing what he needed to do to get the emotions out of Audrey Hepburn. I have to do whatever I can do, whatever I need to do to get the remote viewing in pristine condition from these remote viewers. And well, if I have to lie to them to do it, I'll lie to them to do it. But I will not lie about any, I never lie about the substantive content of our projects once everything's done. The only thing I ever lie about is if someone asks me, hey, do you think you're ever going to do this project? And if it's a project that I like that I think I might want to do, the answer will always be, nah, that's a stupid project. I wouldn't do that. No, we don't, that's not the type of thing we would do. If it's a good project, the last thing I'm going to do is say, wow, that's great. I think we're going to do that, because that means I can't do the project anymore, because the remote viewers listen to these interviews and they would hear it. And as soon as they have a vague idea that something might be possible, the game's over. The project's done. You can't do it. It's finished. It's ruined.
Okay. Well, that's certainly putting it straight. So before we move on, let's talk a little bit about Iapetus itself, just because as a celestial body, it's so interesting. Yeah. And I believe this was the second moon of Saturn, which was discovered. And by the way, people probably don't know, and I was surprised to find out that Saturn has at least 150 satellites, you know, moons and moonlets.
Well, if you include those rings, it's got a ton of junk surrounding it.
And Iapetus itself has got a strange tilt. It's tidally locked, which means it won the same face faces Saturn, as it were, all the time. It's mostly made up of ice, but there's also some rocky material there. And it's got this giant ridge running along its equator, which is 10 meters high. And
it's also got a large splotch dark material on one side. And we actually did a project on that long ago. And that splotch is a result of a debris wave that actually hit Iapetus when a planet exploded in our solar system that is in this place where the asteroid belt is today. Meaning the asteroid belt was once a planet, the planet exploded, and it caused a huge debris wave. And because Iapetus is tidally locked and has no atmosphere, it was holding still while the debris wave passed, and that's what hit it. That was a theory that was developed by Thomas Van Flandern, who was a very mainstream astronomer, head of his Department of Celestial Mechanics for many years at the Naval Observatory in the U.S. And it's not the theory that mainstream science posits for that splotch. Mainstream science has come up with a bunch of different theories, all of which are the stupidest, most ridiculous, convoluted ideas that you can imagine. It's very obvious it was hit by a debris wave, and Thomas Van Flandern actually covers a huge amount of planetary data to support the idea that there was a planet there, it did explode. He doesn't cover the reason for the explosion, but that there was a planet, it did explode. And that for example, the asteroids themselves are huge rocks. The mainstream science says the asteroid belt came from junk that was left over from the primordial solar nebula. Well, that's ridiculous. The primordial solar nebula is dust, and you can't get solid, huge rocks out of dust. Dust doesn't make a rock. A rock forms when a gravity well pulls all the dust together, to produce a planet that compresses the dust into a rock. That's how you get a rock. So the big asteroids had to have come from a big planet. And so there's also evidence that the, extreme evidence that the asteroids had experienced extreme heat because of the glazing on the surface. They had melted. So that's another evidence that, in fact, the asteroids were part of a planet that experienced extreme heat. And anyway, so that's what that dark splotch on Iapetus. You can read about that or watch about that in a project on our website, which is www.farsight.org. And on the lab bar, you'll see something called Exploding Planet. And we have a video presentation that's free and all the data that you can see on that, too.
Interestingly, if one was stood on the surface of Iapetus, Saturn would appear about four times the size than our moon is viewed from Earth. And because of its orbit, Iapetus, that is, Saturn's rings would actually be easily visible, whereas some of the other moons, they see the rings side on, so they don't quite become invisible, but certainly wouldn't get quite
actually,
the same view.
Actually, that's an important point, because when we get to the anomaly on Iapetus, that is the focus of this project, the structures, that's an important point, because one of the reasons that the structures were built there is because of the view, that those rings were literally right above you. Unbelievably beautiful.
And another thing that interested me, just a little bit of trivia from pop culture, is that in Arthur C. Clarke's novel of 2001, A Space Odyssey, which came out in 1968, the astronaut Dave Bowman actually finds the enigmatic alien monolith on Iapetus, but that was changed later.
Yeah, Iapetus has been a great puzzle for many years, and we now have a little bit of an answer for some of the puzzles. There is, in fact, has been some alien activity on Iapetus. I suspect that people have been involved and interested in Iapetus going back hundreds of, hundreds of millions of years, long before humans were interested in it. I suspect that's been an interesting place for a long time.
And there's these massive impact craters on there, which are also somewhat on a couple of the other moons, Mimas and Tethys. And bizarrely enough, they resemble not so much as the Death Star out of Star Wars when viewed from a certain angle. It's just, possibly no significance whatsoever, but it's just interesting.
It is an interesting thing, that ridge around the center of it, plus that crater that looks like the Death Star. It has a weird resemblance.
Now, moving on to the project itself, obviously, again, produced a documentary that's now available, video on demand, also to buy. At the start of that Dick Allgaier session, a couple of things caught my interest, which are probably not unique to this project, but he talked about this briefly about this Nemo mask that he was using in his sessions, and that was rather interesting because I'd seen him use that before. But whether he didn't talk about it, I don't know. But I was very interested in what that was all about.
Well, that comes out of something called neuro-linguistic programming. And what it is, it's a person's, and it's part of the HRVG methodology. And it's a face that's looking towards you, and it's got two eyes in it, and he divides it up into corners. And he's most interested in things that are on his right side, which is the face's left side if it's looking towards you, but it's to his right side. So he's most interested in that stuff. And, this Nemo is a thing to probe, meaning he's probing the visual, the sounds, and the sort of the feel of certain things. And so if he wants to know some sights, some visual stuff, he probes the line that goes from the center of the face up to the right corner if he's looking at it. So he probes upward to the right. And basically, if you're looking at somebody and you're asking the person a question and the person's responding, if you look at the person's eyes, look at where the eyes go initially. They'll flicker. Now, if they go up into that person's left, which you're looking at him, so it'll be to the right, it'll be to your right, but to that person, it'll be to his or her left. That means that they're remembering that, because when the eyes point in that direction, they're accessing a part of the brain that stores memories. On the other hand, if he looks or she looks up and to his or her right, which would be your left, as you're, because you're staring at it, it'll be a mirror image, then the person is lying. The person's creating stuff. So one of the things that I've had conversation, and similarly with sounds is sort of the middle level. So when Dick Allgaier is probing the Nemo to the right, his right, he's listening for sounds that are actually there. He would not probe the left except under special conditions, but he'd probe to the right, because to the right is what's actually there, not created stuff. But I've had some interesting conversations with Dick when we were viewing on YouTube some things that were recorded of people saying things on YouTube, and we were wondering, if they were lying or not. And it's very interesting. There was one instance where there was somebody who was saying he was being chased by the government, that he had inside information, that he was a scientist, a technician. And it looked very convincing. He was sweating appropriately, looking to both sides. It looked like right out of the X-Files. And Dick said, the guy's lying. And I said, how do you know? It looks so convincing. He said, look at his eyes. That means when I'm looking at the screen, the guy's eyes were going to the upper left corner. Now, for that person, a mirror image, it would be to that person's upper right. And so that's where constructed images are. That's where you invent things. That's accessing a part of the brain where you think of new ideas. So he said, look at the eyes. The eyes are going to up to the right, his right, which is up to, we're looking at the screen. So from our looking at the computer monitor, they would be pointing to the upper left corner of the computer monitor. And that's where the lies come out of, because he's constructing something. He's inventing something. And sure enough, he was looking in those directions all the time. And sure enough, a week later, another video came out with the same person confessing that it was all just, it caused a huge internet storm. It was, the ratings were really high. People were saying this X, Y, Z about it. And finally, he just had to come out and stop all the commotion and say, I was just joking. There was nothing. I was just lying. It was just fun. Don't take it so seriously. So it was spot on. And so Dick Allgaier was able to detect that just by looking at the eye motions. So anyway, the Nemo is something that is used in the HRPG methodology. That methodology came out of Special Forces Intelligence in the U.S. Army, and it's not used in the CRV methodology that Daz Smith uses. Daz Smith uses other stuff, and that the CRV methodology came out of the Defense Intelligence Agency's official program and remote viewing. So anyway, that's what that Nemo is all about. It's just a device, a probing device, to allow Dick to get access to certain visuals and sounds and feelings and stuff.
Well, there was a couple of reasons why I asked you about that. First was, second was just hearing Dick mention NLP in his session. But yeah, also prior to seeing your new documentary, a couple of months ago, a listener sent me an email, and it was generally positive about your interviews with me. And he said, Courtney seems to me like a master of NLP. And that hadn't crossed my mind before, so that's why I wanted to ask you about it.
Yeah, the Hawaii Remote Viewers Guild procedures borrow a lot from NLP, neuro-linguistic programming.
Well, that's just interesting in itself. On to Dick's session. Now, he initially begins to perceive land, and then he starts to perceive the artificial nature of something that's there. And then eventually that this doesn't seem to be on Earth. As always, it's just interesting to watch their processes at work, particularly when, you know, you and by the time it comes out, the rest of us have got a pretty clear idea of what they're looking at.
Yeah, that produces a delicious level of tension, because you as the audience knows what the target is, because you actually, you know the the title of the DVD or the video on demand. You know what the project's all about. But it's clear when you're watching it that the recording, the video recordings that were done live when the remote viewing was actually done, it's clear that the remote viewers, Dick Allgaier and Daz Smith, did not know that this project had anything to do with Iapetus. And the interesting thing from this particular project is this, the collection of verifiable data from, let's say, Dick Allgaier's session, since you're raising his session, for example, the level of verifiable data is huge, meaning we have the perfect picture of the anomaly. We have a perfect picture of Iapetus. We have a perfect picture of the crater, all supplied by the Cassini space probe, supplied by NASA. So we have a ton of verifiable stuff. We know it's a crater, a meteor crater. We know it's on an airless moon. We know it's dry, rocky, barren environment. We know all that. We know there's a lot of debris, crater, meteor-type debris scattered all about. So the level of all that is verifiable. Now, the structures, what they, however they were used in the past, that's new information. But if we're to believe the new information, the verifiable data have to be exact. You can't have the remote viewer say, oh, I am seeing Los Angeles, Disneyland, and then go on to describe the buildings and believe what the buildings are about. Meaning, the verifiable stuff, which is the crater, the moon, airless moon, rocky barren terrain, meteor stuff, all that has to be perfect. That's verifiable because we know that to be true. That stuff was some of the best remote viewing I've ever seen done by Dick Allgaier, for example, by anybody. He described the verifiable components of this project so perfectly. I've been doing this for a long time. My jaw dropped. He said, this is just a barren moon, a barren off-world location with a craters and meteor debris all over this stuff. And there's nothing here but land and more land. There's no vegetation, no air. And then he finally says, the only thing I can think about why I would be sent here is there seems to be this stuff in the corner of this crater over here. And I'm going to focus on that now. On the wall of the crater, I mean, he got everything perfect. Greg, I can say this. It was no better. It was no worse. In fact, it was better. It was no worse than it would have been had he been there and seen it with his own eyes. It was better than his eyes because he was able as a remote viewer to move into the structure, to move back and forward in time and to get the full picture. But his description of the verifiable components would not have been even a little bit better had he been an astronaut who flew there and walked around. That's the quality of this remote viewing from these, you know, world-class remote viewers, of which there are very few. But you have one in Britain just around the corner. So, Daz Smith. So these are very rare people. They've really dedicated themselves to this art. They have extraordinary capabilities, but they are an example of what other people should strive to achieve. I always like to say it's like listening to Lang Lang play the piano. If you want to know where it's going, why people should study for years to play the piano, you listen to Lang Lang and you say, oh, so that's what it's all about. Yeah, I'll keep practicing till I can do something similar to that. So that's what these remote viewers, Dick Allgaier and Daz Smith, are like. They're examples for other people to follow.
On that note, actually, just a little bit of an aside. You've mentioned in the past about, you know, perhaps some reservations about the future of remote viewing, not in terms of where the science could take us and change our thinking, but literally in terms of the number of people doing it and where they're going to come from. Now, you point out in your book, actually, Remote Viewing, which I maintain is, you know, pretty much the definitive book on the subject, certainly that I've ever read, that everyone has the ability to do this. And if anyone listening is interested in this is not some, you know, far-flung thing that's restricted to a handful of, you know, savants somewhere on the planet, that we have access to this stuff. And when you begin to understand the broader nature of reality, then it begins to make sense. Like, of course we have access to this stuff, but it's just not something that we've developed. Or maybe it's something that has atrophied over a long period of time. I don't know.
Well, you're absolutely correct. We all have this capability. It all boils down to dedication and passion. Those people who are passionate about something, that's what happens. You know, I was talking to my brother a little while back, and he's a movie maker in New York. And we were talking about our kids and other people's kids and things. And he was saying, he said, Courtney, you know, the thing about what the kids are going to decide to do in life is a time comes when they develop a passion for something, where something happens where it doesn't matter what you're going to do, you're going to do that. There's a level of passion that comes about. And that's what it takes for remote viewing to do well. You have to have a passion for it. So if you have a passion for it as someone who likes to see what can be done, then just watch what some of the world-class remote viewers do on video, so you can see it live on video. And it's really exciting to watch because we've really got it down to a theatrically interesting manner. And that's similar to an audience. For example, I love to go to concerts. I love to go to concerts of all types, from rock concerts to classical concerts to every type of concert. I love going to music concerts to hear the music, to hear the performers. That doesn't mean that I'm gonna perform in all of these things. Sometimes I'm a passionate consumer of this stuff. And so remote viewing is like that. Some people will be passionate about doing it. Other people will be passionate about watching it because it's a participatory sport. You watch it because it's being done under live conditions. It's not like a movie where it's a script and you know it's fake. These things are done live. And when you see them pull in all of the details, all the verifiable stuff, and then they talk about the new stuff that's come out, the new stuff, the backstory, it's to die for. I mean, it is just amazing. You know, for example, there's new information coming out about the 9/11 events that we did a major project on. And I just read a news story today about one of the pilots who flew those exact planes that crashed so-called into the Twin Towers and the Pentagon. I mean, actually flew the exact planes, not on the day of the events, but those exact planes he had flown. And he was saying point blank, he's retiring now, but he said the story that the government said about those planes is just baloney. Those nitwit pilots who trained on Cessna 152s, there is no possible way they could have flown those aircraft. The aircraft themselves could not do those maneuvers. And there's no possible way that those pilots could have done that. He said, even him with like 40 years of experience flying those airplanes, he said he couldn't do it. And it's impossible that people coming out of a Cessna 152 and 172 could have done that kind of stuff. And so, you know, there's more and more information coming out that's building the case that our project on 9/11 was spot on. So, you know, we're patient. We do our projects. We walk away from them after we finish them. But don't count on us missing it. Don't count on us getting it wrong. These projects, given time, you'll find out that they will be accurate. And at some point in time, the whole world will turn in our direction and say, wow, you guys did that with remote viewing. Now let us see. Talk us about this. You knew this stuff before anybody knew this stuff. Tell us how this was done. So these interviews that we're doing here right now, Greg, are actually going to be extremely important. I'm not important. The phenomenon itself to all of mankind, that's important. So these interviews are going to be historical records for how this type of material was done, how it was discussed, how it was presented. And when that moment comes, when the world turns in our direction, these interviews are golden.
Well, the whole 9/11 pilot thing was a bit, you know, I can drive a car, but a bit like strapping me into a NASCAR series race and saying, okay, off you go, you can drive. It's not really the same thing. But talking about the IAPITUS sessions, now Daz also picked up on the artificial nature of some structures and identified that their significance lay in the distant past. And it was interesting what he said as well about perceiving a form of energy, because this came up again later, you know, about energy events. And this really reminded me of the Electric Universe, you know, David Talbot and Wallace Thornhill's idea about plasma sort of events having leaving scars on various planets in our solar system and who knows elsewhere. And I know that theory has been discredited in certain circles, but it is compelling to read, especially when you look at some of the evidence, not only on Mars, but obviously, you know, other planetary bodies as well.
Yeah, you know, that Dyson sessions are really interesting for a couple reasons. He clearly describes the verifiable stuff exactly right. And then he goes on to describe the structure. But he also says that the reason, when he goes back in time, he says, and he clearly identifies it as built on the wall of a meteor. So he said, this is a crater. And he said, at one point, there was a meteor that crashed here and produced this crater, but that the location for building these buildings here was chosen for some special purpose. It's a special spot. It's not just a random spot. And he described how it both in the past and especially in the past, there was a beam of energy that would come down and hit the buildings. Now, I don't know what that was about, but it could have been a form of power generation, because you can generate power elsewhere and then beam it in as a microwave. And that's a well-known technology even today. But it could have been something else. But nonetheless, the energy was from outside going into the structures. The structures themselves are really curious, because this is now combining Dick Allgaier and Des Smith stuff. The structures were, when we think of an alien facility on another planet or a moon, we think of a military base, a spy base, we think of an industrial complex, we think of a mining operation. This was none of that. This was a rich guy. A rich guy, like Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, Richard Branson, the guy who, you know, owns Virgin Airlines. This was a rich guy like those guys, but way richer, far richer than Bill Gates or Warren Buffett or Branson. And this guy obviously had access to flying technology, so he didn't use chemical rockets. He built himself a castle on Iapetus in this very special spot that was a combination health spa, retreat, communal resort, a place for the richest of the richest, the elite of the elite, to go and commune. Now, if you think about it, that location on Iapetus was arguably, probably still is, the most beautiful location in the entire solar system, maybe many solar systems. You're there on an icy, barren moon. You have this incredible palatial set of structures that's there. And right above you is Saturn, all the rings of Saturn, the huge rings right above you, and a completely unfettered star field because there's no atmosphere. It must have been the most beautiful location imaginable. And that rich guy decided to build this facility there. Now, they obviously had means of transportation, like our current UFOs and stuff like that, that could get there in like an hour or two. They obviously didn't use chemical rockets to go back and forth. So transportation was not an issue. But the building of that was not to spy. It was not to manufacture. It was not as a military thing. It was a place to commune with nature, to be, like, think of it as zen, like a zen communal spiritual retreat location. Now, they had staff there, like helping staff, like, you know, hotel staff, but they had people there. And, you know, the anomaly itself, we have very good pictures of it. And for people who want to see the pictures, go to farsight.org, farsight.org, because we're a nonprofit, and click on the big thing that's in the front saying Iapetus. And you'll see the pictures, and the pictures themselves clearly show a set of buildings that have curved facades. There's big windows on the sides of them, and horizontal windows, and then they also have like a staircase that's on the side that turns at a right angle. I don't think it was a staircase, but it looks like stairs. And originally, when it was done, we can see this from the sessions where they go back in time, they had coverings over the entire thing, and one of the sort of covering was like, Dick Elgar describes it as like the St. Louis Arch tipped over on its side. And I was always wondering about why would someone have a roof that sort of looked like that arch? But then I said, it dawned on me eventually, well, that was exactly the shape of the rings of Saturn, which were right overhead. So if you're going to build a covering over the facility, it makes sense that the geometry of the covering would parallel the rings, which are right above. It was a nice touch, whatever the guy did. Anyway, it's a fascinating thing. The other thing that's interesting is that the facility itself was eventually abandoned. And it was abandoned because of a war that took place elsewhere. The war did not directly impact Iapetus, meaning they weren't bombarded or anything like that. But the war happened elsewhere, and that stopped all supply ships. Now, nothing grows on Iapetus. There's no water, there's no air, there's no food. So everything had to be brought in. And when the war happened, all the supply ships stopped. Now, because of our past remote viewing projects, we do know that the asteroid belt was created from a planet that exploded. And that planet that exploded was the reason why Mars is heavily cratered on one side, but has absolutely no craters on the other side. And the cratered side also is thicker by a kilometer, up to 3 kilometers thicker on one side than the other. So whatever exploded was very near Mars. So the argument has been made by people like Thomas Van Flandern that Mars most likely was a moon of this other planet. So the fact that it exploded suggests that it might have exploded as an act of war, and that would have caused the debris wave to spread out throughout the solar system, and that produced a black splotch on Iapetus. Well, let us say that happened. Well, I'm speculating now beyond the remote viewing data, but I'm connecting the dots. When that planet exploded, that would have ruined Mars as a place to go for a long while. Now, we know that that did not kill off life on Mars. Mars life built itself back. We do know that because some years later, say 100,000 years later or whatever, we do know that human civilization did reestablish itself on Mars because the nuclear forensic data on Mars is absolutely unambiguous. There was at least one fission nuclear explosion that occurred on the surface of Mars, and that was the event that blew off the last traces of the Mars atmosphere, so it's thin the way it is today, and people couldn't live there anymore walking around on the surface. Now, that can be read about, for example, in a very recent book by John Brandenburg, who is a very mainstream physicist. He's got a PhD in physics and worked at the Scandia Labs. And he just wrote a book, published it in March of this year, just a few months ago, called Death on Mars, where he goes over the nuclear forensics, which are absolutely clear, the xenon traces and so on. There was a nuclear fission explosion on the surface of Mars. That means that when the planet exploded, let's call that planet that exploded Maldek, for lack of a better word. When Maldek exploded, Mars had a bad day for a long time, but it wasn't the end. But when Iapetus, if I'm still connecting the dots now, when Iapetus had the problem that there was a war somewhere else, it seems likely that it would have happened when that planet exploded, and that war would have made it impossible for ships from either Mars or Maldek, of course, because Maldek didn't exist anymore, to fly out to Iapetus to pick people up or deliver supplies. Now, some of the people on Iapetus, you can assume, had access to ships and could have left, but where would they have gone? Maldek didn't exist anymore, and Mars was a complete wasteland. Well, where do you go? And so what happened, and this is in the remote viewing data, that when the war happened, the supply ship stopped, and the people that were on Iapetus had nowhere to go, and they died there. They ran out of food, they ran out of water, they ran out of air. And if we go to Iapetus today, and we send our own spacecraft there and walk through that facility, we are very likely going to see the bones or the dust of the bones of the people who died there. And they died there because there was no place for them to go. Or even if they did have a place to go, they had no place, no way to get there, meaning they might have run out of ships. The ships that were there might have left, carried some people. The people might, the pilots might have said, we'll come back for you. But when they got back to the Mars Moldak area, they realized it was hopeless to go back. Fuel might have been an issue. I mean, it's just a mess. So the people were in the facility on Iapetus and they died there. And those bones are going to be interesting one day to go look at.
I'm just going to briefly hijack the conversation for 30 seconds because something you said reminded me of a movie that I'd like to recommend to listeners and indeed to yourself if you haven't seen it. It's called The Quiet Earth. And it's set in New Zealand, and there's a bunch of scientists, eggheads, you know, white lab coat types, and they're messing around with the fundamental nature of reality, a little bit like what might be going on at CERN at the moment. And they trigger something called the effect, and the result of that is that almost every human being on the planet just vanishes into thin air. But towards the end of the movie, the effect is triggered again, and the closing scene shows you a beach on Earth, and the whole Earth itself has been moved through the solar system, and looming huge in the sky is Saturn. And it's been commented in, you know, movie reviews and stuff that it's just such a breathtakingly beautiful ending to the movie.
Repeat the name of the movie again.
The Quiet Earth.
The Quiet Earth.
Yeah, so called because, you know, almost the whole population and indeed birds, animals, it just all gone in a split second.
Oh, fascinating.
It is really, really fascinating. But we're talking about, you've just been going through there, your exposition about the nature of activity on Iapetus, but also otherwise on Mars. These common things are coming up again, you know, as with Mars, the situation on Iapetus, the significance of it was in the ancient past. This all happened a long time ago. Those environments now are terribly degraded from the point of view of life. People often refer to Mars as the archetypal dead planet that looks like it could well have had life at one point. And it brings home this idea that even though we're still struggling, well, you know, conventional science is struggling to find any evidence of life in our solar system, other indicators are pointing to the fact that whatever happened in terms of other life, it happened a very long time ago.
The actual dating for this, it's got some pretty good markers for it. Thomas Van Flandern went into some of it, and he suggests that we might be looking at a window like 10 million years, which is not that long ago. And the reason why he suggests that, he suggests that there's some indications that it might even been closer than that, so not even 10 million years out. There's some debate. Some of the nuclear forensic data on Mars, people argue about sort of different dates associated with it. But there's different ways to sort of time when these events happen. For example, some of the dates go as little as 100,000 years. So, and the reason is some of the comets that are coming into the system, you can look at the periods of the comets, and some of the comets are coming in for the very first time, and it looks like they have water, so that they looks like they were part of the planet that exploded and were thrown out of the solar system. So you look at the periods of the comets that are coming in for the first time, and you can get an idea of when the explosion occurs, because you just look at how long it takes for the comet to go around its orbit, the sun, just once. Anyway, I'm not a planetary scientist, but Thomas Van Flandern has published a lot about that, written a nice book about it, and he does go through that dating. But it does appear that we're not talking about hundreds of millions of years ago. And in terms of planetary time, a few million years, 100,000 years, a few million years, is very short. It's relatively recent. So, you know, again, there's other ways to do the dating, and I'm not a dating expert, so I just sort of point you to those other sources where people do just worry about the dating.
Now, one thing that struck me, or another thing I should say that struck me, was the similarities to the Mars project that you did in terms of there being, on Iapetus, there being tunnels, and some of which were underground, and there was a series of chambers, but also struck very much so, just as I was with the Mars project, about certain similarities to ancient Earth civilizations, you know, in terms of the being hierarchical. There's a ceremonial aspect to their daily lives. Symbols are important. Some of the structures are orientated towards certain parts of the sky. It's just stuff that's coming up again and again, and it's very interesting to me.
Yeah, you know, that seems to be a common theme to that early style architecture. They seem to build buildings out of natural materials, and then they dig. They have rooms underneath those buildings. So buildings with subterranean chambers seems to be a characteristic element of a lot of this. And Mars, a lot of stuff was underground. As you can see in our Cydonia project that was released 2 months ago, there is not only a lot of chambers under the so-called face on Mars, which we have no evidence it was a face. It was more like a city. It was 3 kilometers from corner to corner. But not only is there a lot of like rooms and places down there, but there's tunnels, extensive tunnels, and the tunnels extend all throughout the planet. So there's good evidence, both photographic evidence from NASA supplied pictures of tunnels that have been exposed because of erosion, as well as the remote viewing data that suggests that a primary means of transportation around the entire planet in those days was by train, underground train. We don't have any data that suggests that they used aircraft like jets. First of all, we don't know if they had any petroleum products for fuel. And secondly, the atmosphere of Mars, even back then, was thinner. And so it would not have been as useful a medium for flying. And for example, our atmosphere on Earth is very thick. And if you're driving in a car down the street, oh, say 70 miles an hour, well, then you stick your hand out the window, you can really feel that wind hitting your hand as it's going back. So if you're like 90 kilometers an hour and you're really pushing it, that hand is really, it's hard to sort of just keep it out there because of the pressure. Well, when the air is thinner, like on Mars, that pressure doesn't really exist as much. So flying using airfoils, jets and things like that is normal for us given such a thick atmosphere. It wouldn't have been so normal on Mars, I don't think. So trains definitely were a major source of transportation. And those trains were more like the maglev trains that we have today. They were fast. I mean, they were unbelievably fast. They were like our jets of today. They were fast. And I mean, even our maglev trains traveling in Japan and Europe, they go up to 200 miles an hour in some cases when they're in perfect operating condition. Well, these ones on Mars seem to go faster than that. Really, really, really fast. And they were good trains and they looked spectacular. Now, the facilities on Iapetus, you can assume, probably did not have trains. We have no remote viewing data for tunnels like that that extensively go throughout the planet, throughout the moon. What we see on Iapetus is just chambers underneath the surface facilities. So that's a different sort of thing. There wasn't a subway system or anything like that.
I was also struck slightly as well when I think Daz mentioned perceiving something perhaps like a gold covering to one or more of the structures. And
yeah,
that was very interesting to me because I've talked to someone about ancient Egypt and various speculations, you know, drawn from all sorts of sources. Perhaps when it was in its pristine condition, the Great Pyramid, for example, may have been covered in white marble and had a gold capstone. And that would have been visible for miles around on the desert plains. And it would have reflected.
Yeah, actually, some of the remote viewing data we have for our project on the Great Pyramid of Giza does suggest exactly that there might have been a metallic covering, a shiny covering, that the pyramids themselves weren't just rough rock, but they and they weren't just smooth rock either. They might have had a metallic covering to them as well that's long since been, you know, taken off. But nonetheless, there is evidence from the remote viewing side that that did happen. And that's similar to the type of thing you see in Iapetus.
What, if anything, has been gleaned, sensed about the nature of the beings that we're talking about here?
They were like us. They were like us and like the Martians. One of the things about some extraterrestrial species, for example, when we come out with the Phoenix lights, you're going to see something really surprising. A lot of times when you remote view extraterrestrials actually, especially ones that come from other star systems, they can often tell that you're remote viewing them, meaning they turn and you're remote viewing them, and you're almost like you leave a ghostly image of yourself. Anyway, when you show up inside their ship or something like that, they turn right in your direction and start talking to you. So, and we do have stuff of remote viewers interacting with them, and that's something like that is happened for our Phoenix Lights experiment, and you'll see that in a couple months. Actually, you'll see that in about 5 weeks. So, but with Mars, the beings that were on Mars and Iapetus, they clearly did not see us remote viewing them. They looked like us, they acted like us, and they did not perceive us just like us. Because when you remote view humans, humans cannot tell. And so, I like to say that they were us when we were there. So if you want to know what the beings were like on Iapetus, just look around. They were like us. However, they were very rich. They were the elite. Well, and they were not the hotel staff. The staff that worked there were just like normal people. But the people that would go there were the rich and famous. But the Cydonia Mars people, those were different. Those were people that ranged from poor people in shantytown areas up to very rich people, middle class as well. And there was a variety of buildings on that location as well. So you had sort of a mix. But in Iapetus, the whole facility was a palace. It was covered so that, you know, it had to contain the air. I think that thing that looks like a set of steps along the side that has a right angle to it, I think just looking at it, there's a possibility it might have been like a waterfall. It would have been artificial, of course, but part of the rich communion nature of it because of the rippling down and so on. It's clearly an artificial thing, because just looking at the picture of it. But it's way too big to be a staircase where you actually walk up. So it had to have some type of other purpose for it. It's a fascinating project with a very unusual set of structures that were used for an extraordinary purpose that really tell us a little bit about ourselves. Because if we had a person on our planet that was rich enough to be able to do that and had the transportation capabilities to do that, he or she would probably do it. They'd build something like that. And that's what happened.
Just to zoom out briefly and look at the bigger picture of all this, it just so happens that in the last few days I'd read a couple of books by Emmanuel Velikovsky.
Yeah.
I'm thinking now in terms of the idea about, we like to think of our lives, our world on Earth, as evolving but not really fundamentally changing. We like to take the best view of it. But thinking about Velikovsky's writing, and there's lots of other people have written in this area, we take in the idea that enormous changes can happen, even in the ancient Earth. There's this evidence that he, for example, is drawing together about the length of year changing, the length of days changing, the entire orientation of the planet to compare to other celestial bodies changing. And if you allow for that happening throughout the solar system, maybe over very long periods of time, and occasionally if you allow for this catastrophic change, that sets a background against which some of the things that you guys have remote viewed, it starts to fall into a context that, of course, it's just because we tend to be so narrowly focused in terms of time that we can't think about events happening over these huge, you know, cosmic periods.
That's very much what we're heading towards, an awakening where there has been huge level of activity in our own solar system over a great period of time. And we're slowly waking up to that. I want to say that we have a music video where we have different ways to try to reach out to different sectors of the public. And we have a music video that's being released this Friday. And that will act, this music video, it's quite a racy music video. Anyway, it will, it addresses some of these issues that you're talking about right now, the issues of the history of our solar system and humans waking up to the reality of the complexity of that history.
Just in closing, Courtney, a sort of parting thought or a couple of thoughts here is that when we look at what cutting edge science has been telling us now for quite a time and continues to do with increasing bizarreness, it has to be said, about the nature of time, the fundamental nature of matter. And we start to put, say, remote viewing and other psi phenomena into that context, and you understand that all possible pasts are accessible, futures are in some way accessible. And this would also actually speak to issues about potential interplanetary, interstellar transport. You know, how can that be done? We tend to think of it in terms of space shuttles and moon landings and all the rest of it. Remote viewing emphasizes how you could go anywhere, anytime, and not leave your front room. So once you factor all of that in, it puts, again, a bit like the catastrophic nature of the solar system over very long periods of time, this new perspective and new ways of looking at things opens up all those things that you're talking about and more.
Yeah, we're headed towards a big wake-up call one day in the university system. As you know, I'm a university professor, but I don't teach remote viewing or anything dealing with remote viewing. At the university, I'm a mathematician and I work in a social science program. But it's very clear that the traditionally understood mainstream accepted ideas of quantum mechanics and relativistic physics are really obsolete, that they're hopelessly obsolete. They work within a subset of reality, but you can maintain them as sort of paradigms that are perfect only by living in a delusional world that eliminates all other data that shows up to be opposite. So the remote viewing clearly shows you can transfer perceptual information across time and space. And information from a physicist's point of view is the same as energy, literally. Like when you destroy information, you just think of information as stuff you know. But in reality, information is organized stuff. And when you destroy information, you actually release energy in the form of heat. So when you're transferring information across time and space, you're transferring energy, and E equals MC squared, energy equals mass. So physicists are basically dealing with the fundamental paradigms of quantum mechanics and relativistic physics that date back over 100 years. They haven't changed in their fundamentals for over 100 years. So you know they're wrong just because of that. Nothing in science stays that stable. There's always advancement. Now the mathematics have improved. As a mathematician, I can appreciate, you know, the advances that have been made. For example, they have merged the Copenhagen interpretation in quantum mechanics with relativistic physics to come up with the standard model. They can do quantum computing now. They have refined things a lot, but the fundamentals haven't changed since over 100 years. So really what we're talking about is not a challenge to the mathematics, but a challenge to the interpretation of quantum mechanics and the implications to that to macro reality. So we're talking about a generalization of quantum mechanics with a new interpretation of quantum mechanics that is fundamentally tied back to a theory that was developed by Hugh Everett and published in his dissertation in 1957. He studied under John Wheeler in Princeton. And that's called the other world's interpretation of the two-slit experiment. And we're headed towards a realm where that becomes the dominant paradigm. Now, back in those days, in the late 1950s and 60s, essentially only Hugh Everett believed this new interpretation. But now approximately 18% of mainstream physicists have adopted the other world's interpretation as the correct interpretation of quantum mechanics. But that still means 82% are stuck in the old Copenhagen interpretation days, which is a really bizarre interpretation of quantum mechanical experiments. So what we're really waiting for is that 18% is younger generally than the Copenhagen supporters. And so we're waiting for retirement and death to produce generational replacement. And so eventually physicists will have a alternate perspective that becomes dominant that does, in fact, allow for the remote viewing phenomenon to exist.
Courtney, today we've been talking about the new Farsight project, Aliens on Iapetus. This is part two of a three-part series, as mentioned at the top of the hour, including remote viewing Cydonia Mars. That's already available on your website, as you said, has been for a couple of months. We did a big feature presentation on that. That's available at legalizedfreedom.com, as will this be. Phoenix Light's forthcoming, so just share people the details of where they can watch, download, buy, and...
The best thing to do is to go to our website at www.farsight.org. That's F-A-R-S-I-G-H-T, like seeingfar.org, O-R-G, because we're a nonprofit. And while you're there, before you do anything else, please sign up for our free newsletter. Just click the thing, put your email address in. The reason it's important is we are a nonprofit. We do not spend any money on advertising. So our newsletter is the only way we get to tell people what we're doing. And it's free, and we never give out the email addresses for any purpose whatsoever, period, full stop. And we only send it out a weekly newsletter that has a comic associated with it. So it's really to die for. It's really a great newsletter. In addition, that's where you'll hear about our video version of it, which is it's on our YouTube channel. And so if you get to the newsletter, you'll hear about our video channel, which is our YouTube channel, which is filled with tons of stuff. And there's, 98% of everything on the website is totally free, including instructional materials, a full, 20-plus hour YouTube course on remote viewing. And so, there's just tons of stuff at the website to go to. And then the YouTube channel is extremely filled up. And we have a music video coming out this Friday that is going to be a real shocker. Trust me, it'll be a shocker.
Okay, well... Once again, Courtney, thank you so much for joining us on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greg, it's been my honor and pleasure, and thank you.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is LegalizeFreedom.com. That's Legalize-Freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Based on current audience numbers, if everyone who tuned in donated just 5 pence per show, that's about 8 cents US, this could become a full-time, fully funded operation, offering more and more often. During October 2014, over 50,000 of you streamed or downloaded at least one show. Total donations for 7 UK pounds, which currently converts to about $11 US. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.